me that I should have to make several alterations in my work, in regard to which it would be necessary to consult Monsieur Rameau. Deeply grieved at such a result, instead of the praise which I had expected and certainly deserved, I returned home heartbroken. Worn out with fatigue and consumed by grief, I fell ill, and for 6 weeks I was unable to leave my room. Rameau, who was commissioned to make the alterations indicated by Madame de la Poplinière, sent to ask me for the overture of my great opera, in order to substitute it for that which I had just composed. Luckily, I perceived the trick and refused. As there were only 4 or 5 days before the representation, he had no time to compose a fresh overture, and was obliged to leave mine as it was. It was in the Italian style, at that time quite unknown in France. Nevertheless, it gave satisfaction, and I heard, through Monsieur de Valmalette, the king's maître d'hôtel, the son-in-law of Monsieur Moussard, a relative and friend of mine, that musical enthusiasts had expressed themselves well satisfied with my work, and that the general public had not been able to distinguish it from Rameau's. But the latter, in concert with Madame de la Poplinière, took measures to prevent anyone from knowing that I had anything at all to do with it. On the books of the words, which were distributed amongst the spectators, and in which the author's names are always given, Voltaire alone was mentioned. Rameau preferred the suppression of his own name to seeing mine associated with it. As soon as I was able to go out, I resolved to call upon Monsieur de Richelieu. It was too late. He had just set out for Dunkirk, where he was to direct the embarkation of the troops for Scotland. When he returned, in order to justify my idleness, I said to myself that it was too late. As I never saw him again, I lost the honour which my work deserved, and the fee which it ought to have brought me. While I never received the least return, or rather compensation, for my time, my trouble, my vexation, my illness, and the expense which it entailed. Nevertheless, I have always thought that Monsieur de Richelieu was himself well disposed towards me, and entertained a favourable opinion of my abilities. But my ill luck and Madame de la Poplinière combined prevented him from giving effect to his good will. I was quite unable to understand the dislike with which I was regarded by this woman, whom I had done my utmost to please, and to whom I paid court regularly. Gaufrecourt explained the reasons for it. "In the first place," said he, "her friendship for Rameau, whose avowed patroness she is, and who will brook no rival. And in the second place, an original sin which condemns you in her eyes, and which she will never forgive, the fact that you are a Genevese." In regard to this, he told me that the Abbé Hubert, who also came from Geneva, and was a sincere friend of Monsieur de la Poplinière, had done his utmost to prevent him from marrying this woman, whose character he knew well, and that after the marriage she had sworn implacable hatred against him and all the Genevese as well. "Although Monsieur de la Poplinière is well disposed towards you," he added, "this I know to be a fact. Do not reckon upon his support. He is very fond of his wife. She hates you. She is mischievous and cunning. You will never do any good in that house." I took the hint. The same Gaufrecourt also rendered me a very essential service about this time. I had just lost my worthy father. He was about 60 years of age. I did not feel this loss as keenly as I should have done at another time, when the difficulties of my situation occupied my attention less. During his lifetime I had never attempted to claim the remainder of my mother's property, and had allowed him to draw the trifling interest it produced. After his death, I no longer felt any scruples about the matter, but the want of legal proof of my brother's death caused a difficulty, which Gaufrecourt undertook to remove, and did so with the aid of the good offices of de Lulme, the advocate. As I had pressing need of this small addition to my finances, and the result was so uncertain, I waited for definite information with the liveliest impatience. One evening, on entering my lodgings, I found the letter which was bound to contain it. I took it up, in order to open it, with an impatient trembling, of which I inwardly felt ashamed. "What," said I contemptuously to myself, "shall Jean-Jacques suffer himself to be overcome by self-interest and curiosity?" I immediately put back the letter on the mantelpiece, undressed, went quietly to bed, slept better than usual, and got up rather late the next day without thinking any more about my letter. While dressing, I caught sight of it, opened it leisurely, and found a bill of exchange inside. Many pleasant feelings entered my mind at once, but the liveliest of all was the consciousness of my victory over myself. I could mention a number of similar instances in the course of my life, but I am too pressed for time to relate everything. I sent a little of the money to poor Mama, regretting with tears the happy time when I should have laid the whole at her feet. All her letters showed signs of her distress. She sent me heaps of recipes and secret remedies, which she declared would make my fortune and her own. Already the thought of her wretchedness contracted her heart and narrowed her mind. The small sum which I was able to send her fell into the hands of the rascals by whom she was surrounded. She derived no benefit from anything. I was disgusted at the idea of sharing what I myself sorely needed with these wretches, especially after the fruitless attempts which I made to get her out of their hands, as will be afterwards related. Time slipped away, and the money with it. We were two, even four in number, or to speak more correctly, seven or eight. For although Thérèse was disinterested to a degree almost unexampled, her mother was by no means the same. As soon as she found herself somewhat improved in circumstances, thanks to my attention, she sent for her whole family to share the fruits of it. Sisters, sons, daughters, granddaughters, all came, with the exception of her eldest daughter, who was married to the manager of the carriage service at Angers. All that I did for Thérèse was turned by her mother to the benefit of these starvelings, as I had not to do with a covetous person, and was not under the influence of a foolish passion, I committed no follies. Content to keep Thérèse decently, but without luxury, protected against pressing needs, I consented to her handing over to her mother all that she was able to earn by her own exertions, nor did I limit myself to that. But by a fatality which always pursued me, while Mama was plundered by the rascals who surrounded her, Thérèse was preyed upon by her family, and I could render no assistance in either case which benefited her for whom it was intended. It is curious that Madame Lavasseur's youngest child, the only one who had not received a marriage portion, was the only one who supported her father and mother, and that after having long endured the blows of her brothers and sisters, and even of her nieces, this poor girl was now plundered by them, without being able to offer a better resistance to their thefts than formerly to their blows. Only one of her nieces, named Gothon le Duc, was of a tolerably amiable and gentle disposition, although she was spoiled by the example and lessons of the others. As I frequently saw them together, I gave them the names which they gave to each other. I called the niece my niece, and the aunt my aunt, and both called me uncle. Hence the name of aunt, by which I continued to call Thérèse, and which my friends sometimes repeated by way of a joke. It will easily be understood that in such a situation I had not a moment to lose before attempting to extricate myself from it. Supposing that Monsieur de Richelieu had forgotten me, and no longer expecting anything from the court, I made some attempts to get my opera accepted in Paris. But I encountered difficulties which it required considerable time to overcome, and I became more hard-pressed every day. I resolved to offer my little comedy of Narcisse to the Italian theatre. It was accepted, and I was given a free pass to the theatre, which pleased me greatly, but this was all. I could never get my piece performed, and at length, tired of paying court to comedians, I turned my back upon them. At length I had recourse to the last expedient which remained, and the only one which I ought to have adopted. While visiting at Monsieur de la Poplinière's house, I had kept away from Monsieur Dupin's. The two ladies, although related, were not on good terms and never visited. There was no intercourse between the two houses. Thierryot alone was at home in both. He was commissioned to endeavour to bring me back to Monsieur Dupin. Monsieur de Franceuil, at that time, was studying natural history and chemistry, and was making a collection. I believe that his ambition was to be elected a member of the Academy of Sciences. With this object, he wanted to write a book, and he thought that I might be useful to him in this undertaking. Madame Dupin, who also contemplated a book, had almost similar views in regard to me. They would have liked to engage me as a kind of secretary to be shared between them. And this was the object of Thierryot's exhortations. I required, as a preliminary, that Monsieur de Franceuil should employ his own, Angeliot's, influence to get my piece rehearsed at the opera. He consented. The Muse Galante was at first rehearsed several times at the Magasin, and afterwards at the Grand Theatre. The Magasin was the place where the theatrical decorations, costumes, and accessories were kept. There was a large audience at the general rehearsal, and several pieces were warmly applauded. Nevertheless, during the performance, very badly conducted by Rebelle, I felt myself that the piece would not be accepted, and indeed that it could not be presented to the public without great alterations. Accordingly, I withdrew it, without saying a word, and without exposing myself to the risk of rejection. But I clearly saw, from several indications, that even if the work had been perfect, it would not have passed. Monsieur de Franceuil had certainly promised to get it rehearsed, not to secure its acceptance. He scrupulously kept his word. I've always fancied, on this and several other occasions, that neither he nor Madame Dupin were particularly anxious that I should acquire a certain reputation in the world, perhaps for fear that, when their own works appeared, it might be supposed that they had grafted their talents upon mine. However, as Madame Dupin had always entertained a very moderate idea of my abilities, and never employed me except to write at her dictation, or to undertake purely learned researches, this reproach, especially as far as she was concerned, might have been unjust. 1747-1749. This last failure completely discouraged me. I abandoned every prospect of fame and promotion, and without thinking further of my real or fancied talents, which were of such little service to me, I devoted my time and trouble to providing for the support of myself and my dear Thérèse, in a manner which might be agreeable to those who undertook to assist me in doing so. I accordingly attached myself entirely to Madame Dupin and Monsieur de Franceuil. This did not place me in a very affluent position, for the 800 or 900 francs which I received for the first 2 years was hardly sufficient for my most pressing needs, as I was obliged to rent a furnished room in their neighbourhood in a somewhat expensive quarter, and to pay for another lodging quite at the other end of Paris, at the top of the Rue Saint-Jacques, where I went nearly every evening to supper, whatever the state of the weather might be. I soon got into the way of my new occupation, and even began to like it. I became interested in chemistry, and went through several courses at Monsieur Rorel's, together with Monsieur de Franceuil, and we proceeded, to the best of our ability, to fill quires of paper with our scribblings upon this science, of which we scarcely knew the elements. In 1747 we went to spend the autumn in Touraine, at the Château of Chenonceau, a royal mansion upon the Cher, built by Henri II, for Diana of Poitiers, whose monogram may still be seen there, and which is now in the possession of Monsieur Dupin, a farmer general. We enjoyed ourselves greatly in this beautiful place. We lived well, and I became as fat as a monk. We had a good deal of music. I composed several trios, full of vigour and harmony, of which I shall perhaps speak in my supplement, if I ever write one. We played comedies. I wrote one in 3 acts, entitled L'Engagement Téméraire, which will be found amongst my papers, and has no other merit than that of great liveliness. I also composed some other trifles, amongst them a piece in verse called L'Allée de Sylvie, from a walk in the park on the banks of the Cher. This did not, however, interrupt my chemical studies or the work which I was doing for Madame Dupin. While I was growing fat at Chenonceau, my poor Thérèse was increasing in size at Paris for another reason, and on my return I found the work which I had commenced in a more forward condition than I had expected. Considering my position, this would have thrown me into the greatest embarrassment, had not some table companions furnished me with the only means of getting out of the difficulty. This is one of those essential pieces of information which I cannot give with too much simplicity, because if I were to offer any explanation, I should be obliged either to excuse or to inculpate myself, and in this place I ought not to do either the one or the other. During Altoona's stay at Paris, instead of going to an eating-house, we usually took our meals in our neighbourhood, nearly opposite the cul-de-sac of the opera, at the house of one Madame Lecelle, a tailor's wife, whose dinners were indifferent, but her table was always in request, on account of the good and respectable company which resorted there. No one was admitted unless he was known, and it was necessary to be introduced by one of the regular guests. Commandeur de Graville, an old rake, full of wit and politeness, but filthy in his language, lodged there, and attracted a jovial and brilliant company of young officers in the guards and musketeers. Commandeur de Nonon, protector of all the girls employed at the opera, daily brought all the news from that haunt of vice. Monsieur Duplessis, a retired lieutenant colonel, a good and respectable old man, and Ancelet, an officer in the musketeers, maintained a certain amount of order amongst these young people. It was to this Ancelet that I gave a little comedy of mine entitled Les Prisonniers de Guerre, which I'd written after the disasters of the French in Bavaria and Bohemia, but which I never ventured to show or acknowledge, for the singular reason that the King, France, and the French people have perhaps never been more highly or sincerely praised than in this piece. And, avowed republican and censor of the government as I was, I did not dare to confess myself the panegyrist of a nation whose principles were all exactly the opposite of my own. More grieved at the misfortunes of France than even the French themselves, I was afraid of being taxed with flattery and cowardice, on account of the expressions of sincere attachment, the date and origin of which I have mentioned in the first part of this work, and which I was ashamed to make public. The house was also frequented by merchants, financiers, and purveyors, but polite and honourable men, distinguished in their profession, Monsieur de Pesse, Monsieur de Fourcade, and others whose names I have forgotten. In short, good company of all classes was to be met there, with the exception of abbés and lawyers, whom I never saw there, and it was agreed that members of those professions were never to be introduced. The company, fairly numerous, was very gay without being noisy, and many broad stories were told, which, however, were free from vulgarity. Old de Graville, with all his risky stories, never lost his old-fashioned courtly politeness, and no indecency ever escaped his lips, which was not so witty that any woman would have pardoned it. He gave the tone to the whole table. All these young people related their adventures of gallantry with equal freedom and grace. And there was no lack of stories of girls, as there was a stock of them close at hand, since the passage leading to Madame Lacelle's house also led to the shop of Madame Duchapt, a famous dressmaker who at the time employed some very pretty girls, with whom our gentlemen used to go and chat before or after dinner. I should have amused myself like the rest, if I had been bolder. I only needed to go in as they did, but I never ventured. As for Madame de La Salle, I often went to dine at her house after Altoona had left. I there heard a number of amusing anecdotes, and also gradually adopted, thank heaven, not the morals, but the principles which I found established. Honourable people injured, husbands deceived, women seduced, secret accouchements. These were the most ordinary topics. And he who contributed most to the population of the foundling hospital was always most applauded. I caught the infection. I formed my manner of thinking upon that which I saw prevalent amongst very amiable, and in the main, very honourable people. I said to myself, since it is the custom of the country, one who lives here may follow it. Here was the expedient for which I was looking. I cheerfully resolved to adopt it, without the least scruples on my own part. I only had to overcome those of Thérèse, with whom I had the greatest trouble in the world, to persuade her to adopt the only means of saving her honour. Her mother, who in addition was afraid of this new embarrassment in the shape of a number of brats, supported me, and Thérèse at last yielded. We chose a discreet and safe midwife, one Mademoiselle Gouin, who lived at the Pointe Saint-Eustache, to take care of this precious charge, and when the time came, Thérèse was taken to her house by her mother for her accouchement. I went to see her several times, and took her a monogram, which I had written on two cards, one of which was placed in the child's swaddling clothes, after which it was deposited by the midwife in the office of the hospital in the usual manner. The following year the same inconvenience was remedied by the same expedient, with the exception of the monogram, which was forgotten. On my side there was no more reflection, no greater approval on the mother's. She obeyed with a sigh. Later, all the vicissitudes which this fatal conduct produced in my manner of thinking, as well as in my destiny, will become apparent. For the present, let us keep to this first period. Its consequences, as cruel as they were unforeseen, will force me to return to it only too frequently. Here I will mention my first acquaintance with Madame d'Épinay, whose name will frequently recur in these memoirs. Her maiden name was Mademoiselle d'Esclavel, and she had just married Monsieur d'Épinay, son of Monsieur de Lalive de Bellegarde, farmer-general. Her husband, like Monsieur de Franqueuil, was musical. She also was musical, and devotion to the art led to a great intimacy between the three. Monsieur de Franqueuil introduced me to Madame d'Épinay, who sometimes invited me to supper. She was amiable, witty, and talented, and certainly a very desirable acquaintance. But she had a friend, Mademoiselle Dette, who was supposed to be very spiteful, and lived with the Chevalier de Valorie, who did not enjoy a good reputation either. I believe that the society of these two people did harm to Madame d'Épinay, who, although of a very exacting disposition, was endowed by nature with qualities admirably adapted to regulate or counterbalance its extravagances. Monsieur de Franqueuil partly inspired her with the friendship he himself entertained for me, and confessed his relations with her, which for this reason I would not speak of here, had they not become public property, and even reached the ears of Monsieur d'Épinay himself. Monsieur de Franqueuil made singular revelations to me concerning this lady, which she never mentioned to me herself, and of which she never thought I had been informed. I never opened, and never will open, my lips on the subject, to her or anyone else. All these confidential communications from one quarter and another rendered my situation very embarrassing, especially with Madame de Franqueuil, who knew me sufficiently well not to distrust me, although I was intimate with her rival. As well as I was able, I consoled this poor lady, whose husband certainly did not return the love which she felt for him. I listened to these three persons separately, and kept their secrets so faithfully, that not one of the three ever extracted from me any of the secrets of the other two. While at the same time I did not conceal from either of the women my attachment to her rival. Madame de Franqueuil, who wanted to make use of me in several ways, had to put up with a formal refusal, and Madame d'Épinay, who one occasion wanted to entrust me with a letter for Franqueuil, not only met with a similar denial, but I plainly declared that if she wanted to drive me from her house for ever, she had only to propose the same thing to me again. I must, however, do justice to Madame d'Épinay, for Far from showing herself displeased with my conduct, she spoke in the highest terms of it to Francais, and made me as welcome as ever. In this manner, amidst the stormy relations between these three persons, whom I had to manage most carefully, upon whom I in a manner depended, and to whom I was sincerely attached, I retained to the end their friendship, their esteem, and their confidence, while I behaved with gentleness and complaisance, but always with uprightness and firmness. In spite of my awkwardness and stupidity, Madame d'Épinay would take me with her to the gaieties at La Chevrette, a chateau near Saint-Denis belonging to Monsieur de Bellegarde. There was a stage there on which performances were frequently given. A part was given to me, which I studied for 6 months without intermission, but when the piece was performed I had to be prompted in it from beginning to end. After this trial no more parts were offered to me. The acquaintance of Madame d'Épinay also procured me that of her stepsister, Mademoiselle de Bellegarde, who soon afterwards became Comtesse d'Udetot. When I first saw her, it was just before her marriage, and she conversed with me for a long time, with that charming familiarity which is natural to her. I found her very amiable, but I was far from foreseeing that this young person would one day decide the destiny of my life, and was fated to drag me down, although innocently, into the abyss in which I find myself today. Although, since my return from Venice, I have not spoken of Diderot or my friend Roguin, I had not neglected either, and with the former especially I had daily grown more and more intimate. He had a Nanette, just as I had a Thérèse. This was a further point of agreement between us. But the difference was that my Thérèse, who was at least as good-looking as his Nanette, was of a gentle disposition and an amiable character, calculated to gain the attachment of an honourable man. While his Nanette, who was a regular shrew and a fish-fag, exhibited no redeeming qualities which could compensate, in the eyes of others, for her defective education. However, he married her, which was very praiseworthy, if he had promised to do so. As for myself, having made no promise of the kind, I was in no hurry to imitate him. I had also become connected with the Abbé de Condillac, who, like myself, was unknown in the literary world, but was destined to become what he is at the present day. I was, perhaps, the first who discovered his abilities, and estimated him at his proper value. He also seemed to have taken fancy to me, and while, shut up in my room in the Rue Jean Saint-Denis near the opera, I was composing my act of Hésiode, he sometimes dined with me, tête-à-tête, and we shared the expenses. He was at that time engaged upon his Essai sur l'origine des connaissances humaines, his first work. When it was finished, the difficulty was to find a bookseller to take it. The booksellers of Paris are always arrogant and hard towards a new author, and metaphysics, which was not much in fashion at the time, did not offer a very attractive subject. I spoke of Condillac and his work to Diderot, and introduced them to each other. They were made to suit each other, and did so. Diderot induced Durand, the bookseller, to accept the Abbé's manuscript, and this great metaphysician received for his first book, and that almost as a favour, 100 crowns, and even that he would perhaps not have received but for me. As we lived at a great distance from one another, we all three met once a week at the Palais Royal, and dined together at the Hôtel du Panier Fleuri. These little weekly dinners must have been exceedingly agreeable to Diderot, for he, who nearly always failed to keep his other appointments, never missed one of them. On these occasions I drew up the plan of a periodical to be called Le Petit Fleur, to be written by Diderot and myself alternately. I sketched the outlines of the first number, and in this manner became acquainted with D'Alembert, to whom Diderot had spoken of it. However, unforeseen events stopped the way, and the project fell into abeyance. These two authors had just undertaken the Dictionnaire Encyclopédique, which at first was only intended to be a kind of translation of Chambers, almost like that of James's Dictionary of Medicine, which Diderot had just finished. The latter wanted to secure my assistance in this second enterprise, and proposed that I should undertake the musical part of it. I consented, and completed it very hastily and indifferently, in the 3 months which were allowed to myself, and all the other collaborators in the work. But I was the only one who was ready at the time, appointed. I handed him my manuscript, which I had had copied by one of Monsieur de Franqueuil's lackeys, named Dupont, who wrote a very good hand, paying him 10 crowns out of my own pocket, for which I have never been reimbursed. Diderot, on the part of the booksellers, promised me some remuneration, which neither of us ever mentioned again to the other. The undertaking was interrupted by his imprisonment. His pensée philosophique had brought upon him a certain amount of annoyance, which led to no further consequences. It was different with his Lettres sur les aveugles, which contained nothing that deserved censure, except a few personal allusions, at which Madame Dupré de Saint-Maur and Monsieur de Réaumur took offence, and for which he was confined in the donjon of Vincennes. It is impossible to describe the anguish which my friend's misfortune caused me. My melancholy imagination, which always exaggerates misfortune, became alarmed. I thought that he would be imprisoned for the rest of his life. I nearly went mad at the idea. I wrote to Madame de Pompadour, entreating her to procure his release, or to get me imprisoned with him. I received no answer to my letter. It was too unreasonable to produce any effect, and I cannot flatter myself that it contributed to the subsequent alleviation of the hardships of poor Diderot's confinement. Had its severity continued without relaxation, I believe that I should have died of despair at the foot of this accursed donjon. Besides, even if my letter produced but little effect, neither did I myself claim much merit for it, for I only mentioned it to one or two people, and never to Diderot himself. Book 8, 1749. I have been obliged to pause at the end of the preceding book. With the present book commences, in its first origin, the long chain of my misfortunes. Having lived in two of the most brilliant houses in Paris, I had made some acquaintances, in spite of my want of tact. Amongst others, at Madame Dupin's, the young hereditary prince of Saxe-Gotha and Baron de Thun, his tutor, at Madame de la Poplinière's, Monsieur Segui, a friend of Baron de Thun, who was known in the literary world by his beautiful edition of Rousseau, that is, Jean-Baptiste Rousseau, the poet. The Baron invited Monsieur Segui and myself to spend a day or two at Fontenay-sous-Bois, where the prince had a country house. We accepted the invitation. While passing Vincennes, I felt so distressed at the sight of the donjon that the Baron perceived the effects of my emotion on my countenance. At supper, the prince spoke of Diderot's confinement. The Baron, in order to make me speak, accused the prisoner of impudence, which I myself displayed by the impetuosity with which I defended him. This excess of zeal was excused in a man who was inspired by attachment to an unfortunate friend, and the conversation took another turn. Two Germans belonging to the prince's suite were present, Mr. Klüpfel, a man of great ability, his chaplain, who afterwards supplanted the Baron and became his tutor, and a young man named Grimm, who held the post of reader until he could find some other place, and whose modest equipment showed how urgent was his need for finding something of the kind. From that same evening, Klüpfel and myself formed an acquaintance which soon ripened into friendship. My acquaintance with Monsieur Grimm did not advance so rapidly. He kept himself in the background and gave no signs of the boastfulness which he afterwards displayed when he became prosperous. At dinner the next day, the conversation turned upon music. He spoke well upon the subject. I was delighted when I heard that he was able to accompany on the piano. After dinner, some music was sent for, and we amused ourselves for the rest of the day on the prince's piano. In this manner began that friendship, at first so pleasant to me, and in the end so fatal, of which from this time forth I shall have so much to say. On my return to Paris, I received the agreeable news that Diderot had been released from the donjon, and confined to the château and park of Vincennes on parole, with permission to see his friends. How painful it was to me not to be able to run to him on the spot! But I was detained for 2 or 3 days at Madame Dupin's by duties which I could not neglect. And after what seemed 3 or 4 centuries of impatience, I flew into my friend's arms. Oh, indescribable moment! He was not alone. D'Alembert and the treasurer of the Saint-Chapelle were with him. When I entered, I saw no one except him. I made a single bound. I uttered a single cry. I pressed my face to his. I embraced him closely without an utterance, except that of my tears and sighs. I was choked with tenderness and joy. The first thing he did after leaving my arms was to turn towards the ecclesiastic and say to him, "You see, sir, how my friends love me." Completely overcome by my emotion, I did not at that time think of this manner of turning it to advantage. But when occasionally reflecting upon it afterwards, I've always thought that this would not have been the first idea that would have occurred to me had I been in Diderot's place. I found him greatly affected by his imprisonment. The donjon had made a terrible impression upon him, and although he was comfortable at the castle and allowed to walk where he pleased, in a park that was not even surrounded by walls, he needed the society of his friends to avoid giving way to melancholy. As I was certainly the one who had most sympathy with his sufferings, I believed that I should also be the one whose presence would be most consoling to him, and in spite of very pressing engagements, I went at least every other day, alone or with his wife, to spend the afternoon with him. The summer of 1749 was excessively hot. Vincennes is reckoned to be 2 leagues distant from Paris. Being unable to afford a conveyance, I set out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on foot, when I was alone, and walked fast in order to get there sooner. The trees on the road, always lopped after the fashion of the country, hardly afforded any shade, and often, exhausted by heat and fatigue, I threw myself on the ground, being unable to walk any further. In order to moderate my pace, I bethought myself of taking a book with me. One day I took the Mercure de France, and while reading as I walked, I came upon the subject proposed by the Academy of Dijon as a prize essay for the following year. Has the progress of the arts and sciences contributed more to the corruption or purification of morals? From the moment I read these words, I beheld another world and became another man. Although I have a lively recollection of the impression which they produced upon me, the details have escaped me since I committed them to paper, in one of my 4 letters to Monsieur de Malesherbes. This is one of the peculiarities of my memory which deserves to be mentioned. It only serves me so long as I am dependent upon it. As soon as I commit its contents to paper, it forsakes me, and when I have once written a thing down, I completely forget it. This peculiarity follows me even into music. Before I learned it, I knew a number of songs by heart. As soon as I was able to sing from notes, I could not retain a single one in my memory, and I doubt whether I should now be able to repeat, from beginning to end, a single one of those which were my greatest favourites. What I distinctly remember on this occasion is that on my arrival at Vincennes I was in a state of agitation bordering upon madness. Diderot perceived it. I told him the reason and read to him the Prosopopoeia of Fabricius, written in pencil under an oak tree. Prosopopoeia de Fabricius, a soliloquy of the famous Roman general, introduced by Rousseau in his essay. He encouraged me to allow my ideas to have full play, and to compete for the prize. I did so, and from that moment I was lost. The misfortunes of the remainder of my life were the inevitable result of this moment of madness. With inconceivable rapidity my feelings became elevated to the tone of my ideas. All my petty passions were stifled by the enthusiasm of truth, liberty, and virtue. And the most astonishing thing is that this fervour continued in my heart for more than 4 or 5 years, in a higher degree, perhaps, than has ever been the case with the heart of any other man. I worked at this essay in a very curious manner, which I have adopted in almost all my other works. I devoted to it the hours of the night when I was unable to sleep. I meditated in bed with my eyes shut, and turned and returned my periods in my head with incredible labour. Then, when I was finally satisfied with them, I stored them up in my memory until I was able to commit them to paper. But the time spent in getting up and dressing myself made me forget everything, and when I sat down in front of my paper, I could recall scarcely anything of what I'd composed. I conceived the idea of making Madame Levasseur my secretary. I had taken lodgings for her, her husband and her daughter, nearer to my own. And she, in order to save me the expense of a servant, came every morning to light my fire and to attend to my little wants. When she came, I dictated to her from my bed the result of my labours of the preceding night. And this plan, to which I have long adhered, has saved me from forgetting much. When the essay was finished, I showed it to Diderot, who was pleased with it, and suggested a few corrections. This production, however, although full of warmth and vigour, is altogether destitute of logic and arrangement. Of all the works that have proceeded from my pen, it is the weakest in argument and the poorest in harmony and proportion. But, however great a man's natural talents may be, the art of writing cannot be learnt all at once. I sent off the work without mentioning it to anyone, with the exception, I fancy, of Grimm, with whom I began to be on most intimate terms after he went to live with the Comte de Fries. He had a piano which formed our meeting place, and at which I spent in his company all my spare moments, singing Italian airs and barcaroles, without break or intermission, from morning till evening, or rather from evening till morning. And whenever I was not to be found at Madame Dupin's, I was sure to be found at Grimm's, or at least in his company, either on the promenade or at the theatre. I gave up going to the Comédie Italienne, where I had a free pass, but which he did not care for, and paid to go to the Comédie Française, of which he was passionately fond. At length I became so powerfully attracted to this young man, and so inseparable from him, that even poor aunt was neglected. That is to say, I saw less of her, for my attachment to her has never once wavered during the whole course of my life. This impossibility of dividing the little spare time I had in accordance with my inclinations renewed more strongly than ever the desire, which I had long since entertained, of having only one establishment for Thérèse and myself. But the obstacle presented by her numerous family, and above all, want of money to buy furniture, had hitherto prevented me. The opportunity of making an effort to provide a home presented itself, and I seized it. Monsieur de Franceuil and Madame Dupin, feeling that 800 or 900 francs a year could not be sufficient for me, of their own accord raised my salary to 50 louis. And in addition, Madame Dupin, when she heard that I wanted to furnish my own rooms, gave me some assistance. With the furniture which Thérèse already had, we put all together, and having rented some small rooms in the Hôtel de Languedoc, in the Rue de Grenelle-Saint-Honoré, kept by very respectable people, we settled there as comfortably as we could, and we lived there quietly and agreeably for 7 years, until I removed to the Hermitage. Thérèse's father was a good old man of a very peaceful disposition, and terribly afraid of his wife, upon whom he'd bestowed the name of Criminal Lieutenant, Lieutenant Criminel, a former magistrate of the Châtel, the name of two old courts, civil and criminal, of Paris, which Grimm afterwards jestingly transferred to the daughter. Madame Levasseur was not lacking in intelligence, that is to say, in address. She even prided herself on her politeness and distinguished manners. But she had a confidential, wheedling tone which was unendurable to me. She gave her daughter bad advice, tried to make her dissemble with me, and cajoled my friends, separately, at the expense of one another, and at my own. In other respects she was a fairly good mother, because she found it worth her while to be, and she concealed her daughter's faults, because she profited by them. This woman, whom I loaded with care, attention, and little presents, and whose affection I was exceedingly anxious to gain, by reason of my utter inability to succeed, was the only cause of trouble in my little establishment. For the rest, I can say that during these 6 or 7 years, I enjoyed the most perfect domestic happiness that human weakness can permit. My Thérèse's heart was that of an angel. Intimacy increased our attachment, and we daily felt more and more how perfectly we were made for each other. If our pleasures could be described, their simplicity would appear ridiculous. Our walks, tête-à-tête outside the city, where I spent my 8 or 10 sous magnificently in some beer-house. Our little suppers at the open window, at which we sat opposite each other on 2 low chairs placed upon a trunk, which filled up the breadth of the window niche. In this position the window served us as a table. We breathed the fresh air, we could see the surrounding country and the passers-by, and although we were on the 4th story, we could look down upon the street while we ate. Who could describe, who could feel the charm of these meals, at which the dishes consisted of nothing more than a quartern loaf of coarse bread, a few cherries, a morsel of cheese, and 1/2 pint of wine, which we shared between us? Friendship, confidence, intimacy, tranquillity of mind, how delicious are your seasonings! Sometimes we remained there till midnight, without thinking of it or suspecting how late it was, until the old lady informed us. But let us leave these details, which must appear insipid or ridiculous. I have always felt and declared that it is impossible to describe true enjoyment. At the same time, I indulged in a somewhat coarser enjoyment, the last of the kind with which I have to reproach myself. I have mentioned that Klipfel, the minister, was of an amiable disposition. My relations with him were nearly as intimate as with Grimm, and became equally confidential. They sometimes shared my table. These meals, somewhat more than simple, were enlivened by the witty and broad jokes of Klipfel and the humorous Germanisms of Grimm, who had not yet become a purist. Sensuality did not preside at our little orgies. Its place was supplied by gaiety, and we were so well satisfied with each other that we were unable to separate. Klipfel had furnished a room for a little girl, who, notwithstanding, was at everybody's disposal, since he was unable to keep her by himself. One evening, as we were entering the café, we met him coming out to go and sup with her. We rallied him. He revenged himself gallantly by taking us to share the supper, and then rallied us in turn. The poor creature appeared to me to be of a fairly good disposition, very gentle, and little adapted for her profession, for which an old hag, whom she had with her, dressed her as well as she was able. The conversation and the wine enlivened us to such a degree that we forgot ourselves. The worthy Klipfel did not desire to do the honours of his table by halves, and all 3 of us, in turn, went into the adjoining room with the little one, who did not know whether she ought to laugh or cry. Grimm has always declared that he never touched her, and that he remained so long with her simply in order to amuse himself at our impatience. If he really did not touch her, it is not likely that he was prevented by any scruples, since, before going to live with the Comte de Frieze, he lived with some girl in the same quarter of Saint-Roch. I left the Rue des Moineaux, where this girl lived, feeling as ashamed as Saint-Preux, when he left the house where he had been made drunk. And I had a vivid remembrance of my own story when writing his. Thérèse perceived, from certain indications, and above all from my confused air, that I had something to reproach myself with. I relieved my conscience of the burden by making a prompt and frank confession. In this I did well, for the next morning Grimm came in triumph to her, to give her an exaggerated account of my offence, and since that time he has never failed spitefully to remind her of it. This was the more inexcusable in him, since I had freely and voluntarily taken him into my confidence, and had the right to expect from him that he would not give me cause to repent it. I never felt so much as on this occasion the goodness of my Thérèse's heart, for she was more indignant at Grimm's conduct than offended at my unfaithfulness, and I only had to submit to tender and touching reproaches on her part, in which I did not detect the slightest trace of anger. This excellent girl's good-heartedness was equalled by her simplicity of mind. Nothing more need be said. However, I may be permitted to mention an example of it, which I recollect. I had told her that Klupfel was preacher and chaplain to the Prince of Saxe-Gotha. In her estimation, a preacher was so extraordinary a person that, oddly confounding two most dissimilar ideas, she got it into her head to take Klupfel for the Pope. I thought she was mad when she told me, for the first time on my return home, that the Pope had called to see me. I made her explain herself, and made all haste to go and tell the story to Grimm and Klupfel, whom we ever afterwards called Pope, and gave the name of Pope Joan to the girl in the Rue des Moineaux. Our laughter was inextinguishable, and almost choked us. Those who have made me say, in a letter which they have been pleased to attribute to me, that I have only laughed twice in my life, were not acquainted with me at that time, or in my youthful days. Otherwise this idea would certainly never have occurred to them. 1750-1752. In the following year, 1750, I heard that my essay, of which I had not thought any more, had gained the prize at Dijon. This news awoke again all the ideas which had suggested it to me, animated them with fresh vigour, and stirred up in my heart the first leavening of virtue and heroism, which my father, my country, and Plutarch had deposited there in my infancy. I considered that nothing could be grander or finer than to be free and virtuous, above considerations of fortune and the opinion of mankind, and completely independent. Although false shame and fear of public disapproval at first prevented me from living in accordance with my principles, and from openly insulting the maxims of my age, from that moment my mind was made up, and I delayed carrying out my intention no longer than was necessary for contradiction to irritate it and render it victorious. While philosophizing upon the duties of man, an event occurred which made me reflect more seriously upon my own. Thérèse became pregnant for the third time. Too honest towards myself, too proud in my heart to desire to belie my principles by my actions, I began to consider the destination of my children and my connection with their mother, in the light of the laws of nature, justice, and reason, and of that religion, pure, holy, and eternal, like its author, which men have polluted, while pretending to be anxious to purify it, and which they have converted by their formulas into a mere religion of words, seeing that it costs men little to prescribe what is impossible, when they dispense with carrying it out in practice. If I was wrong in my conclusions, nothing can be more remarkable than the calmness with which I abandoned myself to them. If I had been one of those low-born men who are deaf to the gentle voice of nature, in whose heart no real sentiment of justice or humanity ever springs up, this hardening of my heart would have been quite easy to understand. But is it possible that my warm-heartedness, lively sensibility, readiness to form attachments, the powerful hold which they exercise over me, the cruel heart-breakings I experience when forced to break them off, my natural goodwill towards all my fellow creatures, my ardent love of the great, the true, the beautiful, and the just, my horror of evil of every kind, my utter inability to hate or injure, or even to think of it, the sweet and lively emotion which I feel at the sight of all that is virtuous, generous, and amiable. Is it possible, I ask, that all these can ever agree in the same heart with the depravity which, without the least scruple, tramples underfoot the sweetest of obligations? No, I feel, and loudly assert, it is impossible. Never for a single moment in his life could Jean-Jacques have been a man without feeling, without compassion, or an unnatural father. I may have been mistaken, never hardened. If I were to state my reasons, I should say too much. Since they were strong enough to mislead me, they might mislead many others, and I do not desire to expose young people, who may read my works, to the danger of allowing themselves to be misled by the same error. I will content myself with observing that my error was such that, in handing over my children to the state to educate, for want of means to bring them up myself, in deciding to fit them for becoming workmen and peasants rather than adventurers and fortune hunters, I thought that I was behaving like a citizen and a father, and considered myself a member of Plato's Republic. More than once since then the regrets of my heart have told me that I was wrong, but far from my reason having given me the same information, I've often blessed heaven for having preserved them from their father's lot, and from the lot which threatened them as soon as I should have been obliged to abandon them. If I had left them with Madame d'Epinay or Madame de Luxembourg, who from friendship, generosity, or some other motive, expressed themselves willing to take charge of them, would they have been happier? Would they have been brought up at least as honest men? I do not know, but I do know that they would have been brought up to hate, perhaps to betray, their parents. It is 100 times better that they have never known them. My third child was accordingly taken to the Foundling Hospital, like the other two. The two next were disposed of in the same manner, for I had 5 altogether. This arrangement appeared to me so admirable, so rational, and so legitimate, that, if I did not openly boast of it, this was solely out of regard for the mother. But I told all who were acquainted with our relations. I told Grimm and Diderot. I afterwards informed Madame d'Epinay, and later Madame de Luxembourg, freely and voluntarily, without being in any way obliged to do so, and when I might easily have kept it a secret from everybody. For Gouin was an honourable woman, very discreet, and a person upon whom I could implicitly rely. The only one of my friends to whom I had any interest in unbosoming myself was Monsieur Thierry, the physician who attended my poor aunt in a dangerous confinement. In a word, I made no mystery of what I did, not only because I have never known how to keep a secret from my friends, but because I really saw no harm in it. All things considered, I chose for my children what was best, or at least what I believed to be best for them. I could have wished, and still wish, that I had been reared and brought up as they have been. While I was thus making my confessions, Madame Levasseur, on her part, did the same, but with less disinterested views. I had introduced her and her daughter to Madame Dupin, who, out of friendship for me, did them 1,000 kindnesses. The mother confided her daughter's secret to her, Madame Dupin, who is good-hearted and generous, whom she never told how attentive I was to provide for everything. In spite of my moderate means, herself made provision for her with a generosity which, by her mother's instructions, the daughter always kept a secret from me during my stay in Paris, and only confessed to me at the Hermitage, after several other confidences. I did not know that Madame Dupin, who never gave me the least hint of it, was so well informed. Whether Madame de Chenonceau, her daughter-in-law, was equally well informed, I do not know. But Madame de Francais, her stepdaughter, was, and was unable to hold her tongue. She spoke to me about it the following year, after I had left their house. This induced me to address a letter to her on this subject, which will be found in my collections, in which I have set forth those reasons for my conduct, which I was able to give without compromising Madame Levasseur and her family. For the most decisive of them came from that quarter, and upon them I kept silence. I can rely upon the discretion of Madame Dupin and the friendship of Madame de Chenonceau. I felt equally sure in regard to Madame de Francais, who, besides, died long before my secret was noised abroad. It could only have been disclosed by those very people to whom I had confided it, and, in fact, it was not until after I had broken with them that it was so disclosed. By this single fact, they are judged. Without desiring to acquit myself of the blame which I deserve, I would rather have it upon my shoulders than that which their malice deserves. My fault is great. But it was due to error. I have neglected my duties, but the desire of doing an injury never entered my heart, and the feelings of a father cannot speak very eloquently on behalf of children whom he has never seen. But to betray the confidence of friendship, to violate the most sacred of all agreements, to disclose secrets poured into our bosoms, deliberately to dishonour the friend whom one has deceived, and who still respects us while leaving us. These are not faults. They are acts of meanness and infamy. I have promised my confession, not my justification. Therefore I say no more on this point. It is my duty to be true, the reader's to be just. I shall never ask more from him than that. The marriage of Monsieur de Chenonceaux made his mother's house still more pleasant to me, owing to the accomplishments of his young wife, a very amiable person, who appeared to take especial notice of me amongst Monsieur Dupin's secretaries. She was the only daughter of Madame la Vicomtesse de Rochechouart, a great friend of the Comte de Frères, and consequently of Grimm, who was attached to him. It was I, however, who introduced him to his daughter, but as their dispositions did not agree, the acquaintance did not last long, and Grimm, who from that time only had eyes for that which was solid, preferred the mother, who belonged to the great world, to the daughter, who desired friends on whom she could rely, and who were agreeable to her, who were neither mixed up in any intrigue,